Hey y'all, you're tuned into Assigned Sex Unarchived. I'm your non-binary cousin Sean Dawson, and this is a safe space where we're honest about what it means to show up as Black, trans, and genderqueer. Today I'm sitting down with Jade. Jade is one of the original cast members of the Assigned Sex documentary. We're catching up on where she is now, how community and chosen family's been holding her down, and what it feels like to care for your mind when the world keeps trying to misread you. Let's get into it. When we met, you were 21. You wanted to be a model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were living maybe on the Upper East Side.
Yes.
I had put out a Craigslist ad for looking for any like trans people that wanted to be a part of the documentary. You reached out, and I mean, it was on from there.
Welcome back to Living Life Aurora. I am your host, Aurora Jones. And tonight, I have in the building with me the individuals behind the documentary Assigned Sex.
What made you want to do the doc?
Oh, well, at the time, we didn't have really any representation for us, for the trans community. And I felt like I could be people say a real voice, and that's not what I meant. What I mean by a real voice is like real down to earth, someone like everyone can relate to, because I don't try to really sugarcoat anything. I don't try to like fluff anything. I just give you how it is and how I see it. So I thought I would be a good addition to the documentary, honestly.
You were. Do you want to hear what you said the first time when I asked you that question?
Yeah.
God's given me another chance to put my message out there or whatever and tell about my life and my struggles and show that there's somebody out there that's going through the same problems. When it comes to this lifestyle, you have to try to have a lot of self-respect and a lot of morals and integrity, because you can really tend to lose yourself if you let it get that far.
When you say it's easy to get yourself lost out there, what did you mean by that?
It's easy to fall into the wrong crowds for the wrong reasons. I'm so glad I'm matured since then, because I could express myself a bit more and articulate a bit more. When you're that young, you're looking for somebody. You're not really somebody, but you're looking for community. You're looking, when I was that age, I was looking for somebody to mentor me, basically, to show me the ropes. And I got introduced to a lot of interesting characters that, looking back at it now, if I would have probably followed those paths, I probably would have gone down a darker path. I would have gotten into a little bit more things that I probably didn't want to, like substances and other things. And I think that's what I really meant by that, that it's easier to just lose yourself. It's easier to lose who you are and become something that you think society would find acceptable.
So if you're trying to go by like the real world as a female and you're biologically born a male and you have strong features, it's very hard, and people tend to notice. They'll stop and stare at you and make like rude facial gestures and stuff. It's just ridiculous.
You're born and raised in New York, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've noticed that having the pleasure of being born here, I've been able to be around a bunch of different influences, a bunch of different cultures, perspectives. So when I left and went to Boston, New Hampshire, and all those other places, I've realized how blessed I was to be around that kind of community, that kind of like support, because when I left, there wasn't really anything out there that I didn't have that kind of support.
Taken from the GLAAD website, transgender is an umbrella term often used to refer to people whose gender identity differs from their assigned sex at birth. However, people whose gender identity differs from their assigned sex at birth may not self-identify as transgendered. Some may identify as transsexual, trans, genderqueer, or a person of transgender experience, etc., etc.
Yeah, when we met, I remember like your grandma was your rock.
Yeah.
I remember the relationship with your mom wasn't that great. And I remember you having a lot of siblings. How many siblings do you have?
I think there's 10 of us now, yeah.
10?
Yeah.
Sheesh. Do you live with them now?
I live with two of them. So my mom still had my sister Gina. So my sister Gina grew up with my mom. She's been with her the whole time. My mom's kind of supports her a bit because she's special needs. So I'm here with her and my mom. And then we took in my brother Vincent when he got older because he just needed a place.
And you're the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to know how this came back with you being cool with your mom. Because I remember when we started, it was a little tough.
So I think it mainly initiated, I don't know if this was ever expressed. There was a shooting that happened. My mom and my brother got shot by my mom's ex-boyfriend. And
oh my God.
Yeah, it was crazy. I think around that time is when she noticed how much she depended on me and relied on me. And when I tell you, I took a 5-hour trip and turned that into 3 hours. I drove out here so quickly. Well, not me, but we got out here. Did 90 all the way.
Yeah, that'll definitely those type of things will bring family closer.
Yeah, so she realized, I think, how much she needed me more. So she started reaching out more and started actually trying to rebuild our relationship.
Okay, so it's time for a little Black trans and genderqueer history. Today, we're centering the story of Marsha P. Johnson.
Darling, I want my gay rights now. I think it's about time the gay brothers and sisters got their rights, and especially the women.
How will this affect you and your job?
Darling, I don't have a job. I'm on welfare. I have no intentions of getting a job as long as this country discriminates against homosexuals.
Marsha was a Jersey girl. She was born on August 24th, 1945 in Elizabeth, New Jersey to a working class Black family.
What were you like as a kid?
I was one of those religious church boys.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Did you go to church a lot?
Every Sunday, honey. I wanted to learn all about Jesus.
As a kid, she was Malcolm in her mother's house, draping towels and sheets like gowns, already reaching for femininity even when the adults around her kept locking everything back up in the closet. She said she started wearing dresses at the age of 5.
I was young, but I was young and naive when I started wearing dresses at 5 years old. And I stopped for a long time because the boys next door used to try and get fresh with me, you know, try and have sex. Honey, I don't believe you should have sex until after you're married. I found out that boys do have sex. When I was raped by this boy, who was about 13 years old, and he hit me in between my legs, and, he shot all this sticky stuff all over my legs.
By 17, she had $5, a bag of clothes, and a head full of ideas. So she did what a lot of queer kids did and still do. She got on a bus to New York City. On Christopher Street, she reinvented herself as Marsha P. Johnson. And when people asked what the P stood for, she'd say, "Pay it no mind, darling." She was poor, Black, queer, and gender nonconforming at a time when being any of those things could get you locked up or killed. So that little punchline was doing a lot of the heavy lifting. It was a boundary, a joke, and a warning shot to anyone who thought they could tell her who she was. Back in the 60s, downtown Manhattan was already rough for queer and trans folks. But it was especially rough for the street queens, hustlers, and kids who didn't have any rights. Marsha was out there doing sex work, getting arrested all the time, and crashing wherever she could. Even with all of that, she somehow turned sidewalks into runways and the piers into stages.
Our own rendition of Climb Every Mountain sung by Miss Marsha P. Johnson.
She was doing drag, hustling to get her money up, and fighting cops in the same blocks where she was handing out flowers and hugs to kids who just got kicked out of their parents' homes.
I always be now and then meet these young people that don't have nobody that wants to stick by them and help them, you know. So I help them out with like a place to stay or some food to eat or a little change for their pocket. And they don't never forget it. A lot of times I've reached my hand out to younger people in the gay community. They just didn't have nobody to help them out and they were down and out.
On the night of June 28th, 1969, when cops raided the Stonewall Inn, Marsha was right there with the street queens, butch lesbians, street kids, and gay men who had had enough. Other people who were there remember the details differently, but what is clear is that Marsha was in that uprising era as a regular on Christopher Street, and she became one of the faces people attached to that rebellion. She later says she got to Stonewall after the first night had already popped off. Yet the way her name keeps surfacing tells you just how much people saw her as a spirit of that resistance. After Stonewall, Marsha got to work. With Sylvia Rivera, she started STAR, the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. It was basically their version of Chosen Family. They were trying to house, feed, and look out for queer and trans kids who didn't have anywhere else to go, especially the ones doing sex work or living down by the piers.
Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries started out as a very good group. It was after Stonewall they started. They started at GAA. Mm-hmm. Mama Jean DeVente, who used to be the marshal for all the parades, she was the one that talked Sylvia and Rivera into leaving GAA, because Sylvia Rivera, who was the president of STAR, was a member of GAA, and started a group of her own. And so she started Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, and she asked me would I come and be the vice president of that organization.
Marsha's mental health added another layer to her already difficult life. People close to her say she started having nervous breakdowns around 1970. Sometimes she walked down the street naked, talking to voices only she could hear, then get picked up by police and vanish into psych hospitals for months. When she came back, she'd be heavy on meds, moving slow, dulled down for a while until that bright, playful energy started to come back. It's the kind of violence people with serious mental illness know too well. Writers now talk about her through the lens of complex PTSD and neurodivergence.
You just go in there and they just give you medication 3 times a day or 4 times a day. And you just sit around and watch TV. Or you can smoke cigarettes and sit in the dining area and go to sleep.
Sounds kind of boring.
Good to know the rest is good for you.
Yeah. Do you like to go there?
Oh, sometimes, yes. Sometimes you just have these breakdowns that just can't help. I just, you know, wound up broken pieces like the man at the flower shop that I didn't even have a bottle.
On top of all of that, she was living through the AIDS crisis at Ground Zero. In the 1980s and early 1990s, she cared for friends who were dying, including lovers and exes, and acted like a nurse for people in the community who had nobody else. She eventually tested HIV positive herself around 1990 and talked openly about her status, trying to cut through the fear and stigma that was killing people faster than the virus itself. Even with all that chaos, Marsha never stopped showing up. She was out there in the streets as an activist, marching with early pride organizers, joining groups like Gay Liberation Front and ACT UP, and literally putting her body on the line for housing, healthcare, and safety for queer and trans folks.
I believe in as long as there's people with AIDS, and as long as gay people don't have their rights all across America, there's no reason for celebration. That's how come I walk every year. That's how come I've been walking for gay rights all these years instead of riding cars and celebrating everything. Because you never completely have your rights, one person, until you all have your rights.
People remember the flower crowns, the thrift store gowns, and that big laugh that cut through everything. That's why her face still shows up on posters and profile pictures. Why people still call her Saint Marsha. She proved that you could be unwell, oppressed, and still wildly generous and kind. On July 6, 1992, Marsha's body was found floating in the Hudson River near the Christopher Street piers. She was 46 years old. The police ruled it a suicide. Some people close to her, including activists and journalists, have said they believe she might have gone into the water during a mental health crisis, while others insist she was attacked. What everyone agrees on is that the police barely investigated.
We knew that she were towards the end, she was getting more fragile. I think she was getting sicker. I got a phone call and they said Marsha had come up from the bottom of the river. And it was true. Marsha may have hallucinated and thought she saw her father in the bottom of the river, or might have thought that she could walk home across the river to here in Hoboken on the water. You know, or she could have been harassed and jumped in the river to escape. We'll never really know.
The word went out in the community that Marsha had been found in the river and supposedly it was a suicide. And she had been harassed in that area. Obviously, this was some kind of shady killing that had gone on. But unsurprisingly, the cops just twiddled their thumbs and said, no, it's a suicide. It's a black gay person. We don't care. We're not going to investigate any further. And everybody was outraged.
Years later, under pressure from activists, the NYPD changed her cause of death from suicide to undetermined, basically admitting they didn't have the proof they once claimed. An independent medical examiner who re-examined their original reports for a 2017 documentary said there was no clear sign of violent assault, that she likely entered the water alive, but also that you can't see inside someone's mind from an autopsy table. What's wild is how her story keeps pulling people back to the same tension. Was this woman failed by her own brain, by the state, or both? When we talk about mental health for Black, trans, and gender nonconforming people now, Marsha's life is basically a case study in how impossible it is to separate mental illness from poverty, anti-Blackness, transphobia, and the trauma of being criminalized just for existing. The same systems that put her in psych wards, doped her up, and left her on the street are the same ones that shrugged when she turned up dead, which is why her death still sits in that unresolved space. So when we say Marsha P. Johnson now, we're talking about a poor, Black, queer, gender nonconforming person who lived with serious mental illness, survived on sex work, and still managed to mother a whole generation of queer and trans kids. She fought cops, held hands at hospital beds, walked the piers in the crown of flowers, and kept telling anyone who tried to shrink her, pay it no mind, even as her own mind was hurting.
So around the time, 2 years, around this time 2 years ago, my grandmother ended up sending me a message asking me to come back home. Cause I was kind of at a crossroads where I had the opportunity to continue staying in Ohio and continuing the job that I had, or coming back home and figuring it out. So I decided to come back, and then that led to me and my grandmother splitting.
I want to hear about that, because your grandma was like, she was in love with you. I can't even picture... Yeah, I can't even picture you guys not being close.
It's hard because when I left, I changed. I dropped a lot of the negative things that tied me to this city, and a lot of my negative behaviors that I found were negative behaviors. To try to become the person that I am today. Like I stopped being passive aggressive. I stopped beating around the bush. I completely removed that filter that I had, because the filter was getting me absolutely nowhere. And I started defending myself a bit more and standing up for me, and not letting people push me around and take my kindness for weakness. So when I came back out here, I noticed that my grandmother, her issues that she had never really progressed. So when I came back, I noticed that she still had old habits that I didn't like. So one day she just she misplaced something and she tried to, well, she says she wasn't accusing me of stealing, but when you question somebody that you say that you have so much love for and you have so much, trust in, you shouldn't have to ask me if I had it or if I found it or if I, any of, like, 'cause my grandmother has this way of trying to insinuate something without actually doing it. And it kind of ticked me off and I was just like, you know what? I'm done. Like, I can't do with this. So I removed myself from that. And there was that one little, that was that little crack. But then one day this was after I moved out. I was with my mom for a while, got a job, and I was holding it down for a bit and just busting my ass. And I woke up and I hear my mom talking to my grandmother on speakerphone, and she's like talking absolute shit about like my brother's girlfriend at the time, and was just like, oh, all they want to do is lay on their lazy asses and do nothing like la. And I was just like me, what do I have to do with anything? Mm-hmm. Like what? So yeah. I jumped up and in the heat of an Aries passion, I went off and I was just like, what are you talking about? Like, I didn't say what are you talking about. I kind of got a little bit worse than that.
Aries passion.
Oh, if you've experienced an Aries, you know, yeah, we can be
I know Aries like to fight.
we can get pretty argumentative. So, when I heard that, I really threw a lot at her, and that's where I just put my foot down and I was like, you know what? I'm not dealing with this no more. I'm not going to let you belittle me, berate me, and, just put down everything that I've worked hard for to accomplish in my life. So that's where we disconnected. And she's been trying now. Well, not now, but after I spoke to her. But we went, I think, a year without talking. And that's because I was not going to sit there and I wasn't going to try to be the bigger person anymore. I'm tired of being the bigger person. Every time she did something wrong, I'd be the one to be like, hey, so are we good? Let's squash this. But I was like, no, I'm done. Like, she needs to take accountability for her actions. And so that's what caused this rift.
What would you say are your most important relationships now?
My best friend, Jasmine. I don't know if I spoke to her around the time I think I met her after we did this documentary, and she's been such a rock for me. Like, she's been, I actually wrote a song for her. She's been such a positive role model for me. We're both Aries, but she's like, she's more level-headed. She's the logical one. She'll think before acting. I'm the one that acts and then thinks. So we kind of balance each other out. And she's been the one to really hold shit down for me and keep me in a level-headed space. Well, I can't just say her though. There's been a handful of people, honestly. I've got a friend named Aphrodite. She's the one that actually took me from New York. She's the one that brought me to New Hampshire. She's another one that's been holding things down for me. She's been like a huge spiritual advisor for me whenever I'm feeling at a spiritual crossroad or I have some type of spiritual like warfare going on. I go to her always. She keeps me grounded. So I have a network of people that I tend to reach out to.
A support system, which is always good.
What prompted you guys to actually do the documentary? What were the events that led up to you deciding, okay, this is what we're going to do?
I have a few transgender friends, and I've always been curious, just what led up to their transition, what made them want to come to that point, and most of my transgender friends, once they transition, they pretty much cut themselves off. They isolate themselves. And I felt there aren't any transgender mentors out there. So I started doing my own research. I wanted like a peek in. I started YouTubing, Googling. Mm-hmm. And I came across some research done back in 2010. And the suicide rate among the transgender community was at 42% in 2010. And I was like, that is crazy. And I feel that that's because these individuals are finding themselves by themselves.
What did it feel like the first time, like, you had to, like, watch yourself back on screen?
I remember that day, too. I remember that day. I remember that day specifically. I'm trying to remember exactly where I was, though, when we were watching it. I think I was with a few of my roommates at the time. I was in New Hampshire, and I told them about it. I was a bit shocked and nervous. I was nervous because at that point in time, I wanted to put myself out there. I wanted to be a voice for the community, but I was so nervous and so scared because it's the world. Like,
yeah, it's the world.
It's the world. Like, that, putting ourselves out there, it really gives us, it subjects us to everybody's comments, everybody's opinions. And now I know how to block that stuff out and how to just disregard all that because it's just noise.
The hardest part was probably finding the cast. Just finding people that were as motivated as we are, mm-hmm. that are willing to be on the team mm-hmm. and go hard. Mm-hmm. That was the hardest part. And they were confident and had the courage to share their stories. And they don't mind being judged because basically they're putting themselves out there.
Right.
Like, I was tired of answering questions. Mm-hmm. So
that's,
I definitely get that we were all scared about putting ourselves out there and then having to, like, answer mm-hmm. to other people.
Yeah, I was actually talking to a friend of mine who's also trans, and we were basically explaining to another friend of ours that, like, the trans experience as a whole is something that trans people have that ties us together. But everybody's trans experience is completely different. Like, yes, we experience similar things or similar aspects of the trans experience, but it's all a different experience for everybody. So, like, what one person finds easy to live, another person might find as a struggle. And we were actually just sitting down and explaining that to her and just educating, honestly. It's fun. I find it fun to educate people.
From what I've seen so far, the individuals that you do have.
Oh, some character.
Yeah, there are people where it's like, okay, yeah, I want to hear what they have to say.
With you, what stuck out most, and it's great to, like, see this place where you're at now, it was just, like, your mental health. Like, just watching you, like, how much you've grown from back then, like, talking about your mental health to, like, now where you have, like, a solid support system. You seem a lot more, like, optimistic.
Depression actually is a big problem with me. I've actually been diagnosed as clinically depressed. I've cut myself. I've tried overdosing. What else? I think I tried to drown myself once. That didn't work. It wasn't me wanting to actually die, but me wanting to run away from the situation, not wanting to deal with it. I was so confused about my gender, and I had so many questions. Religion was also a big part of it. I actually got admitted into a mental hospital. And once I actually got the experience of what actual crazy was, I was done with it.
Yeah, that was a dark time in my life. Honestly, I think it's because I was relying so heavily on the validation of a partner. Mm-hmm. I was a serial monogamist at the time. Like, I was just going from relationship to relationship to relationship. So my value at the time depended on how that person felt about me, or if I had a person, then I was valuable. But I've changed.
Are you monogamous now?
I'm not with anyone.
Like, where do you find your trans joy these days? What keeps you grounded?
So I've been making music for, like, the past month. I also teaching myself Unreal Engine, which is, like, one of the big engines that a lot of these video game developers utilize for their game performance. So far I've got, like, I think 8 tracks out, which is pretty fun. And yeah, like, it's just something I listened to advice that Beyonce gave Megan Thee Stallion, and I took that and I ran with it. Because
what was the advice?
She was basically talking to her about like all the drinking she was doing, and she was like, well, if you're going to be drinking, why are you drinking somebody else's liquor? Why not drink your own? So the next time I see you, you better be drinking your own liquor. And I think she made her own tequila. And me, I'm at the point in my life where I'm just tired of the nonsense music. I'm tired of the over sexualization in music. I would love to start hearing actual messages in music again, and actual like creativity. So I was just like, you know what? Let me just start putting on music that I want to listen to and that I want to hear. So I'm on Spotify. I'm on iTunes under Fox Sinclair. That's my artist name.
Fox Sinclair.
Yeah. Fox Sinclair was a character. It was kind of, so she's kind of like, she's kind of like Beyonce's Sasha Fierce, but I came up with Fox Sinclair as a character back in like 2011. And that character has always been in my life in some form or way. And I honestly am starting to create a little novel for her. And I started writing, I wanted to make it into an audio drama, but we'll see how that goes. But yeah, no, she's been like my alter ego that I tap into every once in a while, and she's powerful, powerful woman. So I use her to push my music out there. Since I'm not the best vocalist, I use AI generated vocals for my music, mix the beats myself, master my music myself, write my own lyrics. But I get so much backlash for the AI vocals, and I'm just like, okay.
I mean, Jade, I'm going to be real. Like, people are dying, Beyonce. You're sucking up everybody's water, the AI.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is with AI, like, it's so, it's complicated because I feel like, one, I don't think it's sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious where AI will be in 5 years or if it'll still be a thing.
Right.
But then also when sometimes I hear myself thinking about like AI, I'm just like, am I outdated? Cause I remember like just hearing like my grandparents talk about like stuff like don't do this and don't do that. Like my granddad used to have a thing with microwaves. We had a microwave, but we weren't allowed to use it because he's just like, you're cooking your food with radiation. And I was like, why do we have a fucking microwave then? Mm-hmm. if we can't use it?
Right.
And now, like, I find myself, I have a microwave, but I don't use it because I'm like, we're cooking our food with radiation. So with AI, I kind of feel the same. I'm just like, we're using so much water to, like, cool these data centers. Mm-hmm. And they're putting these data centers, like, in the hood.
Yeah, no, I've heard about
people
that.
People are dying, Beyonce.
If you want to connect with Jade, you can find her on Instagram at @officialjade_MUA. You can also stream her music on Spotify and Apple Music under the name Fox Sinclair. The Marsha P. Johnson audio you heard today comes from two places. The documentary Pay It No Mind, The Life and Times of Marsha P. Johnson, directed by Michael Cassino, and an Artifacts interview with Marsha from their Gender Bender series. If this episode dragged you a little bit, or if it hugged you a little bit, please share it with someone you love. You can find me, your non-binary cousin, Sean Dawson, on all platforms at IAMS Dawson. Y'all be safe out there.